Hey, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food. So I'm just juggling here because my Wi-Fi just went out. How is that? But thankfully, I have many different methods of technology here. And, the little green light is flashing. Anyway, I have my phone, and the phone works. It's all good. Lots to be thankful for, like phones and Wi-Fi and options. Thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food. So you may know that just a few days ago was Earth Day, April 22nd, and my birthday. And I'm grateful to all of you who sent me some very nice wishes. I want to direct you, if you have an opportunity, to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, to my daily blog, What Vegans Eat. I did a special one on my birthday, day 802. So I hope you'll check that out. Yes. Now, let's go. I want to bring on my first guest, Barbara J. King. She is Emerita Professor of Anthropology at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and now is a full-time freelance science writer. Barbara has written or edited many books on anthropology and animal behavior. Her latest, just published in March, is Personalities on the Plate, The Lives and Minds of Animals We Eat. Her How Animals Grieve from 2013 has been translated into Japanese, Portuguese, French, winning a book prize, and Hebrew. King's essay on animal mourning in Scientific American was chosen for inclusion in the Best American Science and Nature Writing 2014. She blogs each week for National Public Radio's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. Welcome to It's All About Food, Barbara.
Hi, Karen. I've been so looking forward to talking with you.
Yes, and so have I, and I'm just trying to stay calm right now as I'm juggling with my technical challenges here. But fortunately, I hear you. You hear me. Everybody hears everybody. Yes?
Yeah, yes, I can hear clicking noises, but I can still hear you.
Okay, good. All right. Well, as I try and bring my computer back to life, let's just move forward. So I really enjoyed reading your book, Personalities on the Plate. And the thing that I find so important, as I like to think we're evolving as humans, is that we are able to view other species of life in a different way than perhaps we've perceived them all this time. I know as a performing artist, for example, an actor, we always try to empathize with the role that we're in, the character we're playing. And that's difficult enough. But to try and understand what other species are experiencing and feeling I don't even know if we can do that. But your stories in your book are helping us have a much better understanding. So, one of the things is the patience, I imagine, that's required in observing so that you can write about other species. Is that true?
Oh, yes. I think that watching animals carefully does take time and focus, but what a joy to do as we look at animals in the wild and anywhere from, you know, the oceans to national parks to our backyard. And my work combines some observations that I've done in the past on our closest living relatives, like monkeys and apes, with reliance on what a lot of other people have experienced. And I'm always saying that I'm not, of course, trying to figure out what other animals are thinking, but that they're giving us lots of clues through their behavior to how smart they are and the fact that they're leading, in many cases, profoundly emotional lives. And if we get to know animals and really watch them as closely as we can in their natural context, I think it becomes sort of an amazingly wonderful experience to see how much intelligence and how much emotion we really do share with other animals.
Well, that's such a telling point, because how is it that rather than seeing all of these other species as somewhat similar to us because we share so much in common, we've decided that they're so different?
Well, that is really the question. And what I say in my new writing is that I think we have trained ourselves to, and I mean we in a qualified way, you'll understand that, many of us have trained ourselves to be fascinated by, you know, elephant cognition and how smart dogs are and how chimpanzees feel. But when it comes to farmed animals, the wall goes up, the distance goes up, and we don't want to know. And, of course, I'm excluding your audience from this, but I'm talking about most people. Most people don't want to grapple with the fact that animals that many people eat are, you know, living their lives with true reflection in many cases, the ability to think things through, certainly a strong desire to want to live, and strong bonds of love and grief. So it's generally a question of, you know, why don't we want to see animals in a certain way? But even more specifically, it's the animals that we do choose to engage with in that way and those we don't.
It is indeed complicated. So let's jump to the first topic you cover in your book, insects and arachnids. And there's definitely I definitely get the ick factor when thinking about eating insects. And you talk throughout the book about what different cultures accept as food and what others may find is not appealing as food. It has a lot to do with how we're brought up. But I knew this, but it became more apparent when I was reading it in your book about the quantity of insects we consume without even realizing it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there are these fascinating equations published, you know, eat a jar of peanut butter, eat a chocolate bar, and you're consuming, you know, so many insects. And perhaps that's just inevitable in our current food system. But, of course, entomophagy is about something very different, the purposeful eating of insects. And this, I think, raises a number of really fascinating ethical questions. You know, is it the case that eating insects might, in fact, save some mammals from, you know, being consumed, being produced in agriculture, being consumed? Or do we really want to, and I think the latter is the case, also start thinking about the ethics of consuming, you know, these living creatures as well? If we think for how long the world was kind of convinced that fish don't feel pain, and now, of course, we know they do, we don't want to take it at face value that insects don't feel pain. So yep. I'm kind of wanting to walk that line, and I don't want to dismiss entomophagy by any means in terms of an ethical system, but at the same time, I don't want to repeat mistakes of the past where, you know, you hear very frequently, well, insects, they don't need a lot of space. They, you know, we can easily and humanely kill them. Well, you know, what does that remind you of? What conversation does that remind you of? The whole question of course, humane meat and humane killing and what, you know, what we should take at face value. So it really, there's a lot of sides to entomophagy to consider.
Well, this concept of saying certain things, certain beings don't feel pain, as you just mentioned. I even think about when we talk about circumcision of a human baby mm-hmm. boy, there were many who said that the baby didn't feel pain. And, you know, now there were more people who believe circumcision is necessary. Some will do it with anesthesia. We know those babies feel pain. Uh-huh. And I mean, so many things that we just choose not to want to think about or not to want to see. And, you know, I have to believe that with insects, okay, they're small, but so are microchips. And we continue to figure out how to squeeze so much more complicated information into a smaller space on a chip. What makes us think that these tiny insects don't have some complicated thought processes going on? Maybe not the same as ours, but they certainly do some incredible things. I mean, I'm sure you've seen those pictures of the ant farm art. Mm-hmm. Have you seen those pictures of the guy that does the sculptures in ant hills?
I did. I haven't spent time with them, but I do know what you're referring to.
They're horrifying. I mean, to begin with, in order to make that art, the artist had to destroy so many ants, mm-hmm. because they poured all this, whatever the material he was using, into the anthill. But then we get to see what's really going on underground, and it's just fascinating how they know how to construct their home.
Yes, and quite recently there was a very fascinating study, too new for my book certainly, to show that bees are capable of very thoughtful imitation in ways that have been long thought to just be, you know, something birds or maybe monkeys and apes do. So if you ask bees to roll a ball, something that they obviously would never do naturally, to a target in order to receive sugar water, which is a reward for them, they can learn to do this. But what's more exciting is that they learn sort of more efficiently if they watch a demonstrator bee. That's social imitation. And that shows all kinds of levels of sophistication about how you would want to copy something that someone's doing, how to do that, and all kinds of other things. There's all kinds of stuff coming out about fruit flies making decisions and crickets learning all the time that I think does bear on this conversation in just the way that you suggested, packing a lot into a small brain.
Okay, so now I'm jumping around because you talked about this social imitation, and I was reading later in your book, I'm trying to remember, was it with pigs? How they were easily trained when a human trained them, but they didn't learn from each other for some of the social things that they were trying to be taught?
Oh, I think you might be thinking of goats, possibly.
Oh, it was goats, yeah.
Goats are very smart. You know, this is a sort of time period where there's a goat meme, a goat flare-up, a goat trope going on in our country where everybody wants now little cute goats. And you know how that goes. People get very interested in having pets for a while, and then it doesn't become so interesting anymore. But what I wanted to do is really look at the science, and the book, of course, is based in science, of goat cognition, and it's quite surprising. You know, as you know, I'm sure, goat is an extremely popular meat globally. And again, yes, it's one of those things where it's easy to fall into a trap for some people of, you know, going along with the stereotype of goats as sort of, you know, satanic or dopey or, you know, oversexed or what, you know, pick whatever stereotype. And in fact, when, you know, I was learning and reading about them, I was very moved by what they're able to do in terms of reflection and in terms of learning how to open, say, very complicated fruit boxes. This was carried out at Buttercup Sanctuary in Kent, England, a complicated set of steps that they could remember how to do after 311 days, which is a quite prodigious memory. In fact, they did not very much pay attention to each other. They didn't pay attention in terms of social learning, as I just described for the bees. But that's just their species-specific way of learning. So, you know, it doesn't make them any less smart. It's just the way they go about things.
It doesn't make them any less smart. And every species has their own special skills and knowledge and understanding. But I was just kind of fascinated that the bees, which we would think are not necessarily correctly or smartly, are so far less intelligent than we are, would be able to do something that a goat didn't do.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you said a goat didn't do, because, you know, I think that these experiments tap into some of the sort of social organization and natural evolved tendencies of these animals. But as a person who studied monkeys and apes for a long time, I can tell you that lots of primates that don't use tools in the wild will do so under certain circumstances experimentally. In other words, they have the capacity, even when they don't necessarily show the behavior. So I would be interested in knowing under what circumstances might goats do that, and that I don't know has been done. But you're right, that part of the joy of writing this book was delving into animals that I had an inadequate understanding of. And, you know, the octopus is another, an invertebrate, and you know, sort of off-the-charts smart invertebrate. So when this group of scientists got together in 2014 and they devised the Cambridge Declaration of Consciousness, you know, urging us to think about how many animals in our world are conscious and reflective, they included the octopus, which is now sort of the poster animal for invertebrates, because they use tools, they reflect on what they're doing, they can solve problems in ways that, you know, so many of us dismissed for so long, because an octopus, you look at it and it's hard to necessarily see what we can see in a mammal that we may use to be looking at, or a bird. But an octopus, you know, whatever he or she does is clearly based in just a lot of sophistication.
There are many wonderful stories in here. Some of them are just stories from animals that end up in sanctuaries and are protected. Some of them become companion animals. And then some are summaries and results from different scientific studies that have gone on. And they're all fascinating. I imagine that setting up a study, a scientific study, to be able to determine whether a species is doing something or is aware of something, I imagine that's an incredibly complicated task.
Well, I think back to the book that I did on grieving that you mentioned in your introduction, How Animals Grieve. And, you know, people would push back, which is a good thing. You know, we want to have a dialogue. That's how science proceeds. And ask me, perhaps I was anthropomorphically projecting what I wanted to see in other animals, because clearly I'm an animal lover. I want to see animals as smart and intelligent. But my answer to that is, right, we don't know what an animal is thinking. But if we look very carefully, say an animal has lost a partner, a friend, a relative, and we know something about that animal in its normal behavior before this loss, and then we compare the before to the after, again, the animal itself is telling us something that I believe can be translated into a statement about its expression of emotions. And this, of course, goes way back to Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin wrote fascinatingly about the prodigious emotional expression of animals. So it's possible to do this, I believe, scientifically, carefully, conservatively. So elephants, of course, are the touchstone in grieving, because we know, we can see it so clearly. When an elephant matriarch dies and others come, stand vigil or rock in a distressed way over the body, or socially withdraw and don't eat, that for elephants clearly seems to be grief, and it would be hard-pressed to call it anything different. Then you get to know other animals and look at what their behaviors are after a death. And, of course, in some cases, there's indifference. There's complete neglect of the body and indifference. So animals differ one from another just like we do. But, I truly think that the clues are there to look at.
Absolutely. You covered, in addition to insects and pigs and fish, chickens and cows, mm-hmm. and chimpanzees. You mentioned about chickens. I've heard numerous chicken stories, just how wonderful and loving they can be. And Karen Davis has shared many through her organization, but you also included that one chick in particular who had been bullied when her aggressor became blind. The chicken was able to take out her anger back on her bully.
Yeah, and I did this for a very specific reason, and that is that I don't think it does, you know, any of us any good to romanticize animals. And I live with what sometimes it feels like an astonishing number of rescued cats, and sometimes we have cats that just act meanly to each other. They're good animals, but they sometimes are in a bad mood, or they just feel like being obnoxious. And that's the way that some animals can sometimes be, even when they're basically very loving. There's also the difference in personality. And sometimes, you know, you get a chicken who's just not a very nice chicken. And what I think that that does is it further reinforces the fact that these animals do have personalities, that they do have their own lives, that they get up every day, they want to live, they want to have a good day, right? They don't want a bad day, and sometimes they have bad days. So there's lots of stories in the book of compassion and kindness, but there's the other end of the spectrum too on occasion, and that's, you know, being alive, right? That's what it means to be a complicated individual or set of individuals.
Well, when we see other species that aren't always very nice to their own, does that make it okay that we're not nice to our own sometimes?
Oh, well, I thought you were going to ask me, does it make it okay that we're not nice to other animals? You know, one question I frequently get is, you know, why isn't it okay for me to eat a chicken when, of course, animals kill and eat each other all the time? Well, I would say in two parts. I'm not, you know, instructing anyone what to eat or not to eat. I don't eat chickens, and I never will eat a chicken. Okay. But to me, that's a very sort of false equivalence, because we never evolved specifically to eat meat. We did eat meat in our evolutionary past, but part of the result of eating meat in our evolutionary past is that we have an abundantly complicated brain that allows us to take into account ethics and compassion in ways that I don't think other animals do. So I think the answer is no. You know, it's not okay to treat each other badly. It's not okay to treat other animals badly. And let's take the fact that evolution has, you know, gifted us with these brains and use them in some ways that make sense. You know, this, we don't say that we all want to live in the way that we evolved, right, as human beings, you know, thousands and millions of years ago. We don't wish to recreate the society that we came from. So in the same sense, we need to be on a different trajectory and think differently about the who that we're eating rather than the what.
Absolutely, the who that we're eating. I'm glad that science is moving along and starting to open up and change perceptions of other species. But I'm just thinking some of the things we already talked about in terms of humanity. We all have a wide, vast range of skill sets depending on who we are, where we've grown up, what time period we've grown up in, and what part of the world we're in. And some of us adapt very naturally to some things where others of us don't. And when we talked about those particular goats that didn't learn socially very well and the bees did, maybe if we conducted similar experiments on humans, we'd see that some were able to do things that others weren't. That makes it even more complicated, I imagine.
Well, I think as an anthropologist, I would want to underscore that at the population level, we don't expect to find differences in learning and intelligence, because, of course, that gets into the bad old colonial past, right? So, there is a common human capacity for learning and intelligence. What, of course, changes the trajectory are different individual life experiences and choices and resources and opportunities. And I think that probably plays into this question in a large way.
Yes. Well, there's so much we will not know for a very long time about all those other species, but I'm glad we're starting to dig. So let's just take a moment. I want to talk about chicken pot pie.
Mm.
So you mentioned that there are some foods that you still, you know, miss, I guess, and you haven't been able to find a good chicken pot pie that's made with a plant chicken.
Oh, do you have a good recommendation for me?
I probably could make it for you, but I'm just wondering, what is it about the chicken pot pie in your memory that hasn't been satisfied?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that it is probably far more than just the taste and the texture, but a very cultural experience. And, of course, as I said, I don't eat chickens anymore, and I, you know, just think of this as a comfort food, if you will, a food that made me feel secure. I would eat with family or loved ones. It was, for a number of years, my go-to food when I needed to feel secure and safe and loved. And now I have different go-to foods that don't involve chicken. But I think part of the reason I brought that up is because and I'm certainly not telling you anything you don't know. I mean, I'm learning a lot on this question from animal activists and vegan activists, is how hard it can be to get people to think differently. You know, whenever I write at NPR or my books or elsewhere about, you know, here's an intelligent chicken, or here, look at what this pig did, and this is so cool, you know, the jokes come back inevitably about, you know, bacon and barbecue, and it just sort of never ends. And I really want to try to understand, what is that impulse when one person is feeling deeply about an animal, for someone else to sort of, you know, to do that or to say that? What is it about the way that food has taken on meaning for them that causes that? And that's something I still struggle with.
You are not alone on that one. That's the million-dollar question, or the billion-dollar question. What makes each one of us tick? And some people who appear so sensitive and compassionate still cannot connect the dots when it comes to the treatment of animals, especially for food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have been describing myself as, I would say, experimental. I'm experimenting with new vegan cheeses and vegan milks, and, you know, I eat almost all vegan and vegetarian meals now. And this has been a change in recent years. And so I do try to remember that, you know, some years ago I was in a very different position myself, which I suppose is helpful to think about.
Absolutely. Well, I've been a vegan for almost 30 years, and I've always found that the best way to get people interested in eating this way is to put delicious food in their mouth, and that's been a part of my journey, just creating wonderful, delicious food that is vegan, so people don't feel like they're going to be deprived as their minds are opening up to the truth of what's really going on. So I was just curious about the pot pie, and I have wonderful memories of pot pies, but mine were always made by Swanson, and I'm imagining that the kind that I make today are such higher quality and better, even without the chicken, just because I'm making them from scratch.
Oh, I have no doubt.
Yeah. Anyway, I love talking about food. Great. Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today on It's All About Food. Sorry for the technical difficulties at the beginning of the program. This is a great book, Personalities on the Plate. Thanks for writing it.
Thank you so much, Karen. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. That was Barbara J. King, the author of Personalities on the Plate, The Lives and Minds of Animals We Eat. This is an excellent read for anyone, people who are vegan, vegetarian, or omnivores. It's written from a very open and safe point of view, non-judgmental, and some really wonderful stories. Lovely. I'm going to breathe now. Everyone breathe. It's always important to be mindful of our breathing, isn't it? I haven't talked about breathing for a while. We all breathe for a living. Don't forget that. Before I bring on my next guest, I wanted to just mention We have lost another wonderful advocate for veganism. Just a couple of days ago, my friend and colleague George Eisman passed, and he was a dietitian and an author of several wonderful books, The Most Noble Diet, Food Selection and Ethics, back in 1994, and his Don't Let Your Diet Add to Your Cancer Risk. He did a lot of great speaking all over the country and abroad, and I was fortunate to see him last October, and so sorry to hear about his passing. So, George, thank you for everything. All right, I want to bring on part two's guest, KCT Taft. Dr. KCT Taft is professor of psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine and an internationally recognized researcher in the area of family violence prevention. Dr. Taft has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific articles, chaired an American Psychological Association task force on trauma, and consulted with the United Nations on preventing violence and abuse globally. He has recently published two other books, Motivational Methods for Vegan Advocacy, A Clinical Psychology Perspective, and Trauma-Informed Treatment, End of Intimate Partner Violence. Dr. Taft is co-founder of Vegan Publishers and a dedicated vegan. Casey, hello.
Hi, Karen, how are you?
I'm great. I love talking to dedicated vegans. Thank you for being a dedicated vegan.
Sure. Also, I just want to throw in there, we were very fortunate to publish George Eisman's last book, A Guide to Vegan Nutrition, as well. So we feel very honored to kind of have that distinction of carrying his book and getting to know him a little bit. And it's, you know, we're very saddened to hear the news about his passing as well.
Yes, indeed. What can we do? Just breathe.
Right.
And feel. Yeah. Anyway, such a good guy. I also wanted to mention he was on the board of the Naylith Foundation, a wonderful organization that supports many vegetarian and vegan nonprofit organizations. And the Naylith Foundation has been a wonderful supporter since our inception of responsible eating and living. George Eisman was a part of that.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Right. All right, Casey, let us talk about your book, Millennial Vegan. Why did you write this book?
So, as a psychologist and also as owner of Vegan Publishers, I often hear from younger vegans. They often post on our pages, they send us emails, and they talk about, they write about, you know, their struggles in kind of being vegan, you know, perhaps amongst family members, loved ones who are not too accepting of their veganism, or they write about, you know, how they're being bullied by other folks, like in their schools or in other places or online. And it really just kind of struck me that there aren't really any resources for younger vegans, for millennial vegans, you know, between the ages of 15 and 34. So really this to me was just my attempt to try to support younger vegans because, you know, frankly, I'm in awe of young vegans, you know, who go vegan in spite of all the obstacles, all the brainwashing we all experience. You know, for myself and a lot of folks I know, it took a lot longer for things to click for us and to really develop awareness. But younger vegans do it at an earlier age, and I just wanted to kind of put something out there to provide a resource for them.
Very nice. I don't know if you caught any of my last interview with Barbara King, the author of Personalities on the Plate, but talking about the scientific studies observing other species and how they react to each other in their own natural surroundings makes me think of what a higher intelligence might observe watching humans react to each other in our own circles. I can't imagine that it would really be impressive in some situations.
Right, yeah.
I mean, the way we bully each other and respond to each other is really not something to be proud of, but it's important to have an awareness and skills to manage through that. So that's why your book is important.
Right. Yeah, and well, my day job, I'm a psychologist, and I develop programs to prevent violence and to work with people who engage in violence. So that is one of my kind of specialty areas. So I did want to kind of make sure I touched on bullying and touched on abuse. So people can recognize when they're experiencing it, or even if they're engaging in it, and do something to stop it.
Now, you mentioned that you're in, I forget the words exactly you use, in awe or whatever words you use of the younger people who choose to go vegan.
Right.
And I think, I've said this before on this program, sometimes I think it's easier for younger people to make this change. They haven't been around so long. They haven't had a big history of eating animals for as long. And I know for myself, I started on the vegetarian path when I was 15 years old. I didn't want to eat animals. But a part of what gave me the strength was just wanting to be contrary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think there's probably truth to that. I think it's different for everybody. For a lot of young people, though, they're really struggling with a lot of things, right? They're struggling with their own identities. Many young people nowadays are struggling to find a job and to get out of student loan debt and to kind of deal with all the problems that previous generations have sort of created, you know, and in some ways. So, in some ways, millennials really have it pretty bad relative to prior generations, you know, economically and in other ways. So for me to kind of deal with all of that and to still have the awareness to go vegan, I think is impressive. I know for myself, when I was younger, I felt like I was like too screwed up to make a change like that. Like I felt like I needed to get my life in order and figure things out and get a firmer footing before I can make any kind of change. But I think I knew at a fairly young age it was wrong to do harm to animals, to eat them, to use them in various ways. At some level I knew, but I think I pushed it out of my awareness because at another level I felt like maybe I wasn't ready to deal with that because I was just trying to get my life together.
Yeah, I do know that people can be pretty mean. I remember I was in my late teens, early 20s, and my brother-in-law at the time was ruthless when we would all sit down for a family meal, you know, bombarding me with questions. And he was a lawyer and, you know, was putting me under this grilling of, that's an interesting term to use when we're talking about food, grilling, but asking me all of these intense questions. And I had to speak up for myself. It was really a challenging time. So that's why your book is important. For, you know, I'm a tough cookie. I'm a strong person, and I don't mind being in the midst of controversy. But for a lot of people, it is hard, especially when there are so many other challenges. It's challenging too for adults. I know another friend of mine, also a lawyer, who is vegan, has had a really hard time in business being upfront when. Yeah. At a conference or at a lunch when they bring in food, to just speak up and say, I need to eat this food and not this food. Can you make sure it's here for me?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And the book really, it could apply to those of any generation, really. I mean, most of it is just how to communicate effectively in general. And when I've given talks on the book, I do have older folks who come and they get really active in the discussion and they talk about the struggles they have in communicating with their family members and navigating all these different kinds of situations. So it's certainly not only relevant for younger people. And even myself, you know, as an adult, as an older adult, I've had to deal with all kinds of issues. And as a trained psychologist, I've still had difficulties communicating with loved ones. So I certainly think it can apply to folks from any age group.
You know, as I mentioned, I got on this path as a teenager, and my parents were not thoroughly supportive. They let me do what I wanted to do. They gave a lot of pushback. But I know it's hard for many today. And you mentioned, especially in high school or junior high school, when the child is not the person buying the food or preparing the food, it can make it really, really challenging. You know, we have a transcription program where we have volunteers transcribe these radio programs, like the one we're doing right now will be transcribed shortly. And sometimes I have high school students transcribe them, and they share the same information that they want to be vegan, but they're living at home.
Right.
They can't prepare their meals or shop for their meals, and it's hard.
Yeah, I hear those stories a lot. People message me about their situations fairly often, and it really is kind of heartbreaking where you have a younger person who really doesn't want to do harm to animals, and they feel like they don't have a choice because they have no control over the food that they're eating. And it really is hard for them. I can't imagine what that would feel like if you really feel a strong moral conviction to not do harm to animals, and yet you feel like you have no other choice but to consume them. That must be really hard.
Yeah. Now, you also have a section on it's lonely being a vegan, or it's lonely being vegan. And I think it really depends on where you are. I imagine there are some locations that's really a lot lonelier than in other places. Fortunately, with social media, we have the opportunity to find like-minded people anywhere on the planet these days.
Right. True.
Yeah.
True. But loneliness one can also feel lonely even if you're kind of surrounded by people, right? I mean, one form of loneliness that I often hear about is when one is with people that they care about, and people that, perhaps their whole lives they've been able to share how they're growing, how they're changing, how they're evolving, their interests, and what's important to them. And then all of a sudden, they're going vegan and they want to share it with people they care about, and they get this kind of pushback, and they feel like nobody really wants to hear about it. And in fact, sometimes just by our presence as vegans, other people can get really defensive around us and feel like they have to defend themselves or defend eating animals or what have you. And that could be kind of alienating too. Also, for some folks, when they feel kind of alienated or lonely when they share the message of veganism with loved ones, they try to share with other people what they've learned about the harm we're doing to animals, and the other person who they know to be otherwise kind and compassionate and caring is totally non-receptive to the message. So that also can be really sort of alienating. So there are lots of ways that we can kind of feel isolated and alienated, even if we do have other vegans around us. It certainly helps. The more of a vegan community we can kind of build for ourselves, and social media and all of that does help, but it still can feel lonely when the people you care most about or you're closest to, where you feel like they're rejecting you or rejecting your message.
You brought up two different instances in the book that I want to bring up, and what we can do in those different situations. I really appreciated them because they happen all the time. So I hope I remember the two. Number one is somewhat positive. So you're eating with your family, or you're in a restaurant, and the non-vegan person, the non-vegetarian person, is trying to help you in your selections, or is aware of your eating differences and is making a point to bring that out, their awareness of what you're eating. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a good thing, right? That sensitivity. I know sometimes it can be frustrating when I'm in a restaurant. like when somebody says, oh, look, you can have this on the menu and you can have this on the menu. And,
right.
you know, you could read the menu too, but they feel a need to be helpful. And is there a good way to respond to that?
So when somebody is kind of positively showing understanding for your veganism, yeah, I mean, I think letting other people know that you appreciate that, appreciate when they're when they do kind things for you, when they make you a vegan meal, or if they have a vegan gathering, you know, without animal products. I think it's really important in our relationships to not only let other people know when we're unhappy about things, but also to point out the positive things people do for us. That's kind of a that's something that we do a lot in couples therapy and family therapy, where we try to work to show other people that that we recognize when they do something nice for us. And the more we pay attention to that, the more we let other people know that we notice that, the more nice things they're going to do. So you're kind of reinforcing those positive behaviors.
Yeah, I could do more of that because, you know, when somebody's pointing out on a menu what I can eat, I have this reaction like, I can see what's there, but I need to make an effort to be more encouraging and thankful and appreciative for their concern. The other one right. is kind of the opposite, and that is when people, like you said, are defensive. So you could be at a restaurant, or you could just meet someone and they find out about what you eat and their reaction is, oh, I don't eat a lot of meat, or I don't consume a lot of dairy, or, you know, I only do this. And as a psychologist, what's happening?
Well, I think what's happening is they're experiencing some level of guilt and shame because we as vegans are really walking reminders of the harm other people do to non-human animals. So people who I think people have some general awareness that they're eating dead animals or the secretions of animals. And I think they know that these animals are harmed in some way, but they find different ways to kind of push it out of their awareness. But we are kind of direct reminders of the harm that they do. We can bring out these kinds of shame responses simply by saying we're vegan. And oftentimes, the more strongly we advocate for animals, the stronger the shame responses are. I typically argue that, you know, we should be mindful of how we're engaging in animal advocacy, where we shouldn't engage in name-calling or the really aggressive kind of labeling of other people and that kind of stuff, because that really heightens their shame response and it makes it pretty much impossible that they're going to listen to anything that we have to say. But on the other hand, we should not shy away from talking about the harm we do to animals. We shouldn't shy away from speaking out for our animals. And some people are going to have this shame response no matter what we do. And we have to keep in mind that, you know, we're not responsible for their reactions, that they're the ones who are ultimately responsible for their own feelings.
All of these things that you're saying, especially this one, applies to everything, not just veganism.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, it's something we talk about a lot. We talk about a lot as a psychologist, for sure.
Yes, and when, you know, a lot of the things that you brought up in the book, navigating relationships, all of the advice that you give will work in dealing with your food choices, but it works. These are classic concepts in navigating relationships.
Exactly.
And sometimes I think, you know, you mentioned dating vegetarians and being in a romantic relationship with someone who might not eat the same way you do. And a few decades ago, I could have done that. I don't think I could do it today. Unfortunately, I live with a wonderful man who is vegan. So we're very happy here. We both love to cook and we make great food. Right, not everybody's that lucky.
Right, exactly.
But when you eat differently, that can magnify the problems you already have in communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think that's true. And also, you know, like you're suggesting, I could never date a non-vegan either. I'm married as well to a vegan. But it's hard to imagine to be with somebody who has such a fundamental kind of different point of view ethically. You know, I think unless that person is open-minded and they're willing to consider changing, or they're trying to change, or they're trying to grow or evolve in some way, I think that would be really difficult. And I do hear a lot of stories from vegans who are dating or with a non-vegan, and they just at some point decide that they just can't do it anymore because it kind of goes against like their fundamental ethical beliefs. So that really is difficult. I think it gets more challenging where folks who are not vegan, they weren't vegan when they started dating, and then one person changes and the other person doesn't, and that gets more complicated because they have differences in kind of their expectations for their relationship. But yeah, it's really difficult for a lot of couples to navigate these differences, for sure.
Okay, outside of this wonderful book, your bio says that you're a professor of psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine. Do you have an opportunity to do any vegan proselytizing while you're at the university?
That's a good question. you know, I mean, to be honest, not too much. So I'm primarily a researcher, a clinical researcher. So I run groups, I run clinical trials. So a lot of what I do is really working with patients and working with folks in my own lab and colleagues. So these conversations come up a little bit with my colleagues, but I'm not ever in front of a large group of students giving lectures about veganism. Unfortunately, at this point in my career, my animal activism and my day job, where I'm preventing violence towards humans instead of non-humans, they're sort of separate, and I'm still trying to think of ways to bring it together, because I do think all forms of violence and oppression are linked in various ways. So I would like to bring it together, and I have actually started working on another book that does bring it together more about how we can prevent all forms of violence. But in my day-to-day job, I mostly focus on how I can end domestic violence. And then when I get home, I focus on how we can end violence towards non-human animals.
Well, dealing with the violence in human relationships is a very real challenge. Humans can be violent, and yeah, we see it with how we treat other species, but we treat our own selves so poorly. We're violent against our loved ones, and we're violent against ourselves.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
How do we fix that? How do you treat that, Casey?
How do you treat violence?
How do you treat that? Yeah.
that's a tough to come up with a fast answer for that. I have written a book about that. What I found to be the most effective way to reach people is you have to, just like in animal advocacy, you have to help somebody want to change. You have to figure out where they are in terms of their readiness for changing and work with them to decide to make that change, to come up with a clear goal to change. And I think, just like in our animal advocacy, when I'm trying to get somebody to end their violence, I actually listen. I make an effort to listen to them. I listen to their story. I listen to their history of trauma. And I have them tell their story. And once they tell their story and whatever they've experienced, most of the people I work with have been abused they've experienced various forms of trauma. Once they feel like you've listened to what they have to say, then they listen to what I have to say, and they're more likely to join with me in wanting to end, you know, various forms of violence and abuse. So I think listening is a big part of it. Dealing with trauma is a big part of it. Helping them set goals is a big part of it. And then teaching them really specific strategies for how to, once they decide to make the change, how are they going to go about doing it? And so I wrote a book on these general ideas applied to animal advocacy called Motivational Methods for Vegan Advocacy, which I think the general rules for change and how we help other people change really are fairly consistent, whether we're talking about animal advocacy or ending other forms of violence.
Okay, well, Casey Taff, thank you for all of that, and thank you for being the kind and intelligent, sensitive person you are with humans and with non-humans. I think all of us appreciate the work that you're doing and for writing Millennial Vegan. And thank you for joining me, and it's All About Food today.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you for having me. It was great.
Yeah, we're just about out of time, so I wanted to thank you for joining me. And that was Dr. Casey T. Taft, author of Millennial Vegan, Tips for Navigating Relationships, Wellness, and Everyday Life as a Young Animal Advocate. Okay, just a couple of minutes left. I wanted to remind you, coming up this Saturday is the beginning of the Food Revolution Annual Summit. And I'm a part of that, as I am or have been for the last few years, offering up new recipes every day of the summit. It's a 9-day event. It's free. And if you visit responsibleeatingliving.com, you can sign up and register. And it's an amazing event. And if you can't listen in the morning when the interviews are aired, they are available for a full 24 hours. Check it out. It's also Tuesday. All my shows are on a Tuesday, but I just wanted to highlight that for those of you who are into Taco Tuesday, we have a tasty tempeh Taco Tuesday meat. It's a plant meat, of course, but it's a wonderful recipe, and you can find that too at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Oh, well, look at that. Here we are. It's the end of another It's All About Food show. Thank you so much for joining me. You can always find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com and email me at info@realmeals.org. I love hearing from you. Thanks for listening. And remember, have a delicious week.